Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hello, I'm Larry Mealer. We're going to be taking a look at late summer garden pests and diseases, and we're going to take a look at woody ornamentals today as well. Laura Jell, professor and extension specialist, who's a specialist in woody ornamentals in the Department of Horticulture at UW-Madison, one of our guests. Hi, Laura.
Hey, how are you, Larry?
I'm great. How are you doing?
I'm doing well.
And Brian Huddleston looks pretty healthy. He deals with unhealthy plants a lot, but he's looks pretty healthy. He's director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at UW-Madison in the Department of Plant Pathology. Brian, great to see you.
Good to see you. They're not my personal diseases. They are the plant diseases.
Well, I tell you what, we always get lots of questions, and I'm going to give the number, although our lines are already filled. Here's the number, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org. And go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mealer Show, and you can post a photo there. Several people have already done that. And so you might want to go to it right now because you're going to be able to see some diseases of vegetables and fruits actually look like as we discuss them. Again, go to the Larry Mealer Show. We're almost at 2,000 people, so we need to get a few more people just to get us over the 2,000 mark.
Let's go for 10,000, Larry.
Yeah, well, 1,000 at a time. So
okay.
We got the 1,000. Now we're almost at the 2,000, and moving on. So we have lots of callers online. If you're thinking about things this summer. Disease-wise, anything that really stands out?
I think the big thing that we saw early in the season, and it's continued on through the summer, we had a lot of problems with conifers, particularly spruces, showing issues with needle cast diseases. So these are fungal diseases that infect the needles and cause the needles to fall off. And so I got a call this morning from someone who has a thinning spruce tree. The interior needles on the lower branches are falling off.
So that's one. Laura, how about you?
I'd say the biggest issue this summer has been the umprellis herbicide issue, the damage that unfortunately resulted from application of umprellis to turf grass. It leached to the root system of many evergreen species as well as deciduous.
Oh.
And it's caused incredible damage.
Damage.
Many of these trees I don't think are going to come back, especially the conifers. They're brown all over the new growth. In fact, they look horrible.
Oh.
And I've seen a lot of samples in the clinic as well. We routinely look at those, trying to rule out any sort of disease problems and then give our best estimate as whether we think it's an herbicide issue or not.
Yeah, and I have a fact sheet on that I put together for umprellis, and it's on the Wisconsin Urban Horticulture Team's website.
In fact, there are two of them. There's one that Jim Kearns, who's our turf pathologist, I'm also an author on that. Chris Williamson, I believe, is also an author on that. Doug Soldat. And that talks a little bit about umprellis as well. And then Laura's fact sheet that deals with how to try to manage the trees after they've been exposed.
Yeah, and it's got pictures as well as of the damage.
Oh, that's, for some reason, it's the first time hearing of it or the first time remembering hearing of it anyway. That's terrible.
Yeah, it's been not only here in Wisconsin, but all across the central and eastern part of the United States.
All the way down to Georgia.
Oh, man.
You want to give the website?
For the Wisconsin Hort website is hort.uwex.edu.
Okay.
And there's no www on the front of that.
You know what? We've got a photo here of some tomatoes on our Facebook page at the Larry Mealer Show. And let's take a look at those red tomatoes with that. It looks like blossom end rot in some ways, but it's on the side of the tomato.
Yeah, we also had a photo on the website that was of some peppers that had a very bleached sort of lesions on there or areas on the sides of the fruits. And I'm wondering if the tomatoes may be something very, very similar, except just a slightly more advanced stage. And on the peppers, for certain, I'm pretty sure that's sun scald or sunburn. Lots of times with the fruits on plants like peppers or tomatoes are exposed to a lot of hot sun. They can actually, the tissue is actually damaged by the heat, and you'll get these kind of bleached areas. And I'm wondering on the tomatoes whether that's what initiated the problem, because if it were blossom end rot, I would expect it more on the bottom of the fruits.
Right,
and this
absolutely.
Is very much up on the sides, almost to the top of the fruit, but it is kind of on the side of the fruits. And I'm wondering if those were exposed to a little bit of sun. And we have had some very hot days. And what I can see, there looks like there's a lot of fungal growth in there, but I suspect it's fungi that have come in after the tissue was damaged and are just colonizing that dead tissue. So if you've got plants that have been defoliated by some of the tomato leaf blights, and so the fruits are more exposed to the sun, you can get increased injury of the sort.
We have Katie in Green Bay with a question for you, so let's go there. Hi, Katie. Thanks for calling.
Hello. Actually, I have a little letter here from Brian himself.
Hi.
Because I had taken something in to be diagnosed, and it said you had said no evidence of fungal pathogens. However, I did recover a fluorescent species of the bacterium, Pseudomonas.
Pseudomonas,
and
yes.
And you advise that I put on either copper or mancozeb.
Yeah, was this a lilac by any chance?
No, actually, it was the peonies. But
oh, peonies.
I now notice that it seems to be affecting other other plants that I have in the garden. I was under the impression, although you did not say it in the letter, that it should be something I do in the spring. But now I'm wondering whether I should just go out and do it now.
Yeah, if you're having problems, the organism that we really worry about, and one of the reasons why I most likely made the recommendation of the copper and mancozeb, is there's an organism called Pseudomonas syringae. It's a bacterium. It's a fluorescent bacterium. So it produces a diffusible pigment that if you shine ultraviolet light on it, actually glows. And there are certain, did you send this in early in the summer or early
I
in
did,
the spring?
I did.
Yeah.
From VJ.
Yeah. And, the recommendation really makes me think that it did come in early, because there are certain, variations on this particular bacterium that are what are called ice nucleating organisms. They actually have a protein in their outer membrane that mimics an ice crystal. And so if the plants come up, you have a lot of this bacterium on the surface of the plant, and you get a cold snap, it might not be a low enough temperature for the plant to normally freeze, but if you've got this bacterium on the surface, it can actually induce frost damage. And so one of the ways to try to manage that is an early application of something like copper or a combination of copper and mancozeb. We oftentimes recommend this for controlling bacterial blight on lilac, which is caused by this particular bacterium. And so that's the reason why I recommended that. But it would be an early season application, particularly if it looks like the plants are coming up and then we get kind of really cold temperatures where there might be a frost, then that would be a situation where you might want to consider this. This organism is very, very common. It actually grows on the surfaces of plants, oftentimes without causing any disease at all. It's what's called an epiphyte. And so it's the part of the natural microflora on plant surfaces. Very, very cool organism. I happen to have done my PhD work on a disease caused by this organism. So it's really, really cool.
Thank you.
Just one quick question.
Yeah, sure.
So you're recommending then that I wait till next
spring? Yeah, I would wait till next spring. And okay. If you're seeing problems on other plants, it may not necessarily be this particular organism. It could be something else that's causing the problem. Again, this sort of organism, if it's going to cause this frost injury or cold injury sort of effect, it's going to be something that happens earlier in the season. And this organism does cause disease, but the host where we normally see it would be lilac. We can also see it on snap beans. It causes, if you ever have snap beans with little brown spots on the fruits or on the pods, that's oftentimes caused by this particular bacterium.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. I've got an email from Sklomo who says, our plum trees are infested with black knot fungi. Is there a natural remedy for that?
Pruning.
Yeah, pruning
is it, huh?
Well, yeah, this is the disease that I affectionately call poop on a stick. And that's because that's what it looks like on the trees. And it's a disease that's specific for prunus species, so cherries and plums. And pruning is about the only thing to do. We recommend pruning 4 to 6 inches below where you see the galls, those swollen areas on the branches, and disinfest the tools between cuts. So I suggest dipping them in something like rubbing alcohol, or you can get a can of one of the spray disinfectants. Just check the label to make sure that it's about 70% alcohol. Spray it until it drips, allow the tools to air dry, and then you can make a pruning cut.
Ellie and Eau Claire, we're on to you now. Hi, Ellie.
Hi there. I have an oak tree that is losing its acorns already. They're dropping like they would drop if they were, you know, mature acorns, but they're dropping now and they're green. My neighbors have a stand of birch tree that is dying. I mean, the leaves are all turning brown on the birch trees. I'm wondering if there could be some cross-contamination there, or if it's the oak that's supposed to be in Eau Claire.
What's happening with the oak trees? A lot of times oaks will produce a very heavy amount of fruit, and it's a process of natural thinning. They'll drop a lot of the fruit that either wasn't fertilized naturally. A lot of times during a drought as well, they'll drop a lot of fruit. But if there's some still remaining on the tree that will mature, do you know what kind of oak it is?
It's either a bur oak or a pin oak, and I don't remember which one.
Okay, well, there's a difference. With bur oak, your acorns will mature in a year. With the red oak group, like pin oak, it takes 2 years for the acorns to mature. That doesn't mean you'll go 2 years without the fruit. It's just a natural process. Some are maturing at an earlier rate than others, but it's actually pretty natural to have some fruit drop this time of year as it's going into fall. It sheds the excess fruit that doesn't have a viable embryo or just excess that it can't keep going.
Mm-hmm.
Regarding the birch, is it a white birch species? Yeah, okay. It could be a number of issues. Japanese beetles are really bad this year.
Yeah, and they really like...
Oh, yeah.
Take a look at the leaves. Do they look really lacy?
From where I'm sitting, I really can't tell.
Okay. Yeah, definitely go out and take a look at the leaves and see whether it looks like they look like lace. And if that's the case, then it's most likely Japanese beetle.
Yeah. There's other issues with birch. There's also bronze birch borer, which causes dieback from the top of the tree down. Also drought. Birches don't like drought.
Yeah. I was talking with Bob Bozold, one of my former students who is at Wax Radio in Eau Claire and does farm radio up there, and he was saying that the Eau Claire area was really hit this year hard by Japanese beetles.
Yeah, same with my house.
I can drive down the street and I can tell which trees are the lindens because
yes.
They're all bronze.
They're brown.
Bronze at the top
brown.
Of the tree.
Oh, they're
top.
Horrible.
Thank you, Ellie, for calling. Appreciate it. Catherine and Wausau, we're on to you now. Hi, Catherine.
I have a question about tomato plants, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Anyway, one of the... questions I had may be answered because my tomatoes seem to have like a blemish. And what you were talking about before, the sunburn,
mm-hmm.
That maybe is what it is.
Where's the blemish on the fruit? Is it on the sides or is it on the bottom?
Well, it's on the sides.
Okay. Yeah, and again, we tend to see that kind of burn sort of symptom if they're exposed to the sun. There are some fungal diseases, though, that will cause spotting on fruits as well.
But I also have, my main question was, the bottom leaves of my tomato plants have turned yellow. I cut them off. I keep cutting them off as they yellow. Is that blight?
Yeah. Are you seeing spotting on those yellow leaves as well, kind of brown spots?
Yeah.
Yeah, it could be one of the leaf blights. Are you seeing any, you mentioned blemishes on the fruits. Are you seeing small blackish-looking blemishes, or are they larger blotches on the side?
It's like something within the skin of the tomatoes, on
okay.
Some of the tomatoes.
How big are they in diameter? Are they really tiny, or are they larger areas?
Oh, they're maybe a quarter, half.
Okay. Yeah, it's probably not. The reason I'm asking this is there are some bacterial diseases that get on tomatoes that could cause some leaf yellowing and leaf loss. But those typically also cause blemishes on the fruit, but they're very small, usually pinpoint size or maybe a quarter of an inch in diameter. But it sounds like you have two different things that are going on. Probably the disease that you're dealing with on your tomato leaves is either a disease called early blight or one called septoria leaf spot. They're both fungal diseases. They usually start at the bottom of the plant and work their way up,
yeah.
And it's very typical in home gardens. And what we recommend in terms of management, at this point, it's a little bit late to do anything, but what you want to do is plan ahead for next year. So be very diligent when you put your garden to sleep this fall, that you clean up as much of those tomato plants as you possibly can. And I would get rid of those tomato plants. You can certainly compost them if you want to, but you really have to be doing good, proper composting where you get high temperature and rapid decay of the plant material in your compost pile. If you're like me, where I just throw stuff into a pile in the backyard, this is stuff that should not go into that sort of pile. Next year when you plant, try to move the plants to another area in your garden and space them as far apart as you possibly can. You really don't want any branch overlap in the plants because you want good airflow to help dry them very quickly if they get wet. And then mulch underneath the plants. And I would also go back to the area where you had tomatoes last year and mulch over that area because the fungus can kind of survive in little bits of tomato plant that you haven't been able to collect up. and those will be in the soil, and you want to prevent any spores that are produced down there from getting up out of the soil and onto your new plants. And then when you water, do not water with a sprinkler. You want to get something like a soaker or a drip hose and put it down towards the base of the plant so you're applying the water to the soil, and you don't want to get it on the leaves.
Mm-hmm. And what about if you have those tomatoes, let's say, in a pot,
mm-hmm.
and you would you be able to save the soil and use that in another year, or
I
would you not? No,
I would. You know, no. My recommendation is try not to do that, because what you want to do is prevent buildup of organisms in the soil that might potentially cause even more serious problems than the leaf blights. There's some soil-borne pathogens that cause actually wilts on plants, and those can build up over time in the soil.
Okay, so even probably composting that soil from the pots, you wouldn't do it.
You know, it's not bad to reuse that somewhere for something else, because that's the same sort of idea of rotating. It's just in this particular case, you're kind of rotating the soil rather than rotating the plants. So
yeah,
you can reuse the soil. It's just I wouldn't use it for something like tomatoes or related crops.
Thanks, Catherine, for calling. Appreciate it. Brian Hodelson, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at UW-Madison. Laura Jell, professor and extension specialist in horticulture and woody ornamentals here at the UW-Madison. Our guests here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. When you call our number, 1-800-642-1234, the very capable and friendly Judith Sears Poisson, our producer, will happily answer the phone and put you online to talk with us. That's 1-800-642-1234. Arlene in New Berlin, you are next. Hi, Arlene. Thank you for calling.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call. And the reason I'm calling, you had a the young lady was talking about the spruces or Colorado blue spruces with that insecticide that they sprayed.
It's an herbicide.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's an herbicide. And yeah. Thank you so much for calling me young lady.
Well, anyway, I have three Colorado blue spruces on the west side of my house, and I do have a service that comes out and sprays the lawn. The two big ones are fine. It's the smaller one that just got maybe about an inch. That's the tips are burnt off, or the needles are still on, but they're dry. And I had someone come out and look at my trees because I had another issue. But anyway, he said to soak the ground. Will I lose that tree?
Okay, a couple questions. Is this a newly planted spruce?
No.
Okay.
No, it's, in fact, when we moved into the property 7 years ago, the thing was, the little Colorado blue spruce was shorter than I am. Now it's taller than I am.
No. Okay. Second question, is it every tip or just a few here and there?
No, we looked at it yesterday and it looks like it's not... It looks like it's about, I want to say every tip, but I can't see up on top.
Okay.
And I had Wachtel Tree Service come out.
Yeah, they're awesome. They're very good.
And he said to soak, he said to water the, to water it really good. It's just the real, you know, the growing tip of the plant. And
Okay.
That's where we've been seeing the umbrellas. Have you talked to your lawn care company?
Yes, and they also said they pulled it off. They put it in on in early spring.
Yeah.
And, it's not every single one. It's just a couple of them.
So they did put down umbrellas.
Yeah.
Okay, see,
I
even if it was an early spring, you're seeing the damage now. And chances are this might be an umbrellas issue. It's not an insecticide, it's an herbicide, and it was sprayed on lawns to take care of the weeds.
And does a great job.
And does a great job at getting rid of the weeds.
Does,
however, the product, they've soon realized that tree roots growing in the vicinity of the turf, this particular herbicide moved down and into the roots of these trees, and especially at the time of year when many conifers, as well as deciduous material, are starting to leaf out, the herbicide gets pulled up into the xylem, the water-conducting tissues, goes inside the plant, and concentrates at the growing points, at the tips of the leaves, as well as the tips of the roots. And so seeing dead tissue at the tips is what we're often referred to as umbrellis injury. I do have a fact sheet on it on the web, on the Urban Horticulture Team's website.
HORT.UWEX.EDU. And if you're interested in really trying to figure out whether this is potentially an umbrellis issue, about the only thing way to really confirm it is to do a residue test. And that service actually is offered through the Michigan State University Plant Diagnostic Lab. You can go onto their website and just download one of their submission forms and submit the sample and just tell them you want an umbrellis residue test.
We don't. There's nothing in Wisconsin, right?
No,
we have nothing here.
Yeah.
The company is coming out. They're going to send a representative out to look at the tree too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's good. Sounds like they're a company that wants to take care of its customers. Yeah, for sure. Well, thank you, Arlene, for calling. I appreciate your call.
And sorry you're having problems with that. You're not alone.
Yeah. And it's not the turf, the person who sprayed it. I mean, they thought it was safe.
We have an email from Sarah who wonders what happened to my daylilies this year. I'm not the only one whose plants have fallen over and look brown at the base. Doesn't seem to be a moisture issue.
Yeah, it could very well be. There's a leaf disease of daylily called daylily streak. It's a fungal disease, and certain varieties are quite susceptible, particularly the kind of the old-fashioned orange-flowered ones are quite sensitive or susceptible to the disease, and oftentimes the disease will start out as kind of a streak of yellow and then brown in the leaves, but eventually the entire leaf can collapse. And this is one of the situations where, because it tends to recur every year, I talk to folks about how emotionally attached are you to that particular daylily. And if you're not attached to that particular daylily, then my suggestion would be to do a little research and get a different variety that has a higher level of resistance to the disease. And quite frankly, one of the things to do is find a botanical garden that has a nice collection of daylilies that are labeled with the names, and then you can go out and you can see the ones that are really susceptible. In fact, at the West Madison Agricultural Research Station here in Madison, they have a fairly large daylily collection, and if you're in the Madison area, you could certainly stop out there and take a look at the varieties that they have.
And this weekend, the Wisconsin Daylily Society is holding its sale at Olbrich Gardens in Madison on both Saturday and Sunday. Okay. They'll have somewhere around 800 varieties.
Wow.
And they, I just talked with a couple of the representatives on Wednesday, and they have a lot of information about each of the plants, and of course, you can buy those plants there. Yeah.
And if I may plug something else, next Saturday is the West Madison Ag Research Station Hort Day.
Yes,
it runs from
always fun
10 to 3. I will be there. Phil Pelletieri will be there.
It's on the 20th, right?
20th, that's correct. Mm-hmm. And come and take a look at the displays. They have a trial garden out there where they grow lots and lots of different ornamentals. They also have grapes now, both table and wine grapes. And you can come and talk to folks about that and a variety of horticultural issues.
We have Steve from Broadhead up next. Hi, Steve.
Hello. Hi. I have a Japanese beetle problem. And I really, really, really hate to use pesticides, but I've been trying to use a perithrin-based pesticide. And I really have to be careful. I have a lot of shrub roses, so I don't want, you know, they're very sensitive to pesticides, but it doesn't really seem to be doing much. Is that just because I'm not seeing the beetles being killed right away, or is it just not being effective?
You probably have so many in your area that even if you are killing some of them, a lot more are just flying
in.
Right.
And that's the common problem with Japanese beetle, is that you can try to treat on your own property, but there are so many of them in the environment that you're just creating a vacuum and more just come right in. And if you have sensitive plants, oftentimes I recommend, if you've got the time, is just to pick them off and put them in some soapy water.
And watch them die.
And watch them die, yeah. I had somebody at the fair earlier this week who actually puts them in just regular water to keep them alive and then feeds them to his chickens. So if you happen to have birds, chickens,
turkeys,
they love them.
Yeah, at the Arboretum, UW Arboretum, the wild turkeys come in and I just sit and watch. They just feast on them.
Do you happen to have a golf course or anything of that sort, some place where there's a lot of lush grass nearby?
No, not really, but okay. If I'm close to the country. I'm only about 5 blocks from Farmfield.
Oh, they'll travel a long way.
A long ways. Yeah. But if you happen to be near a golf course or a place that has a lot of well-maintained
cemetery.
Lawn, yes, yeah. then you can have an increased population of Japanese beetle because they tend to lay their eggs in lush turf.
Yeah. The grubs cause damage to turf roots, and then the adults emerge from the grass. And they feed on just about every landscape plant in my yard.
Yeah. Right. And roses are a big one.
Yeah.
But the pesticide I'm using really doesn't matter.
No.
It's just
no.
there's so darn many of them.
Yeah.
Okay.
You're going to have to, if you're using a pesticide, reapply it because they keep coming in. And I agree. I don't like using pesticide on my plants. I have 2 dogs and they eat everything, including the grass. So really the best bet, and I know this is very labor intensive, is hand pulling them off if you don't want to use pesticide.
Yeah.
And the other thing is a little bit of patience, because what we've tended to see in certain areas is that you get a big influx for a couple of years where you have a lot of Japanese beetle, and then it will taper off a little bit to a more manageable level. And hopefully that'll happen in your situation as well. That actually has happened in my own yard here in Madison. Where
mine too.
I had a real bad, probably about 3 or 4 years ago, and then it's tapered off since then.
Thanks for calling, Steve. Appreciate it. Sylvester in Stoughton, on to you now. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. I have a magnolia tree in the backyard, and they had me spray some. I went to the plant store, and they had me spray some all-season spray oil on it. I think it's called Bonide. Or Bonide, and the tree has like these white scaly things all over the branches, and juice is like dripping from the tree like rain, and there are flies and all kinds of bugs there, and it leaves like a black mildew moldy thing on the ground, and I can't get rid of it, and I'm not sure how to go about it.
Yeah, what you're seeing is probably either...
Probably magnolia scale
on the magnolia. And the sticky stuff that you're seeing is actually a result of the honeydew or other material that the insect is producing. And it's very sticky. It attracts sooty mold, which actually grows on it, which is black. There are 2 times of the year that you can control scale. Probably the best time is in the dormant season. And you would be using a product called dormant oil. And this has to be used, I think it's below 40 degree or 50 degree temperature. Dormant oils are very safe. They're sprayed on the actual branches where the scale, and what it does is it smothers them. Another time of year, you can use horticulture oils, which is when the temperatures are a little bit warmer, but below probably 80 degrees, because you can cause some phytotoxicities. With horticulture oil, it's a special formulation that is used to take care of the scale. And then the third time, actually, is the crawler stage. And this is typically for magnolia scale, phenology-wise, I'm not sure.
We do have a fact sheet on this if you need details, because I don't remember the details on this. Are you hooked up to the internet?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, if you go to our horticulture website, and we gave out that URL earlier, that's the hort.uwex.edu, and just type in magnolia scale in the search engine that's on there, and you should be able to pull up the fact sheet, and it'll give details on timing of application.
The crawler stage is when the eggs underneath the main covering hatch, and they're very tiny little insects that crawl on the actual branches, and then they find a new home.
But you've got to get the oils on when it's that crawler stage, because they're soft bodied and they're more sensitive to the oils. If you try to apply that to the actual scale with a hard shell, the oil won't necessarily penetrate the shell.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Just had some breaking news on Imprelis. A caller, Bob from Bailey's Harbor, wanted to point out a New York Times article just yesterday. The Environmental Protection Agency ordered DuPont to pull Imprelis from the markets, ban sale of it, expect more than $1 billion of damage. And grass and DuPont has announced plans for a refund program. And the grass treated with it should never be composted because it doesn't break down.
Yeah. The cuttings from grass, you should not use them as mulch or put in your compost pile.
Let's go to David in Fox Lake, Illinois next. Hi, David. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. I got a problem in my home garden this year. Had it actually 3 seasons ago also, and lost about 90% of my yield. I think from the research I've done, it looks like I have blossom end rot on my tomatoes and all my peppers.
Okay.
I wonder if you guys know any secrets to counteract this mid-season.
Yeah, so it's primarily a you're seeing a rot on the bottom surface of the fruits. Is that correct?
Correct. Black.
Yeah. And that's actually not a disease. It's actually a nutrient deficiency. And the plants are short on calcium. So what you need to do when you plant them into the ground in the spring, add a little additional calcium to the soil. So something like bone meal. I would not use lime. That tends to raise the soil pH. So you want something that will supply the calcium but not change the soil pH. And then the other thing, as they begin to start to set the fruit, the peppers and the tomatoes, you want to make sure they're getting plenty of water and relatively even water. Because what we sometimes find is that you've got plenty of calcium in the soil, but if there's not enough moisture in the soil, you can't get the calcium moved from the soil into the plants.
You also don't want to over-fertilize your peppers or tomatoes with nitrogen. Too much nitrogen will promote leaf growth, and they've actually shown in some research that it can actually promote blossom
and rot as well.
There you go. Thank you for calling. Bill in Wanakee. Your turn. Hi, Bill.
Yes. I have a question in regards a white oak tree. This white oak tree is planted near a drain field, and I have a couple of curious things that happen. In the spring, early spring, all of its leaves get eaten almost down to the veins. It then supplies new leaves, but all the leaves, at least in the last 5 years or so, are very yellow, chloroic, and they just never seem to get dark green.
Okay.
I've used systemic insecticide because I've been using it for with my elms, which seems to be helpful with these old elms, but it doesn't seem to have stopped the attack on the leaves in the spring. I don't see the attacker. They must be very small. And I'm not sure the reason for the yellow leaves.
Okay, I can address the yellow leaves. White oak is an oak species that absolutely must have A, good drainage, and B, they like an acid soil. And when the soil pH is too high, if it's too alkaline, they will develop what's called chlorosis, where the leaf turns yellow and the veins a lot of times remain dark green. So it's interveinal chlorosis. And that's a telltale sign that there's probably a root issue going on, meaning you could have the soil pH is too high, or even if the soil is waterlogged. White oak is very sensitive to that. Regarding the leaves, something feeding on it, it could be gypsy moth.
And my other thought, because you mentioned that it occurs very early in the spring, is that correct?
Yes,
it could be a phenomenon called tatters, which is a physiological disorder. It's not caused by an insect or a fungus, but we sometimes see situations where oak leaves will be very, very lacy, and it will look like something has fed on the leaves. But what we think is probably happening is as those leaves are first emerging, they get a little bit of cold injury, and that induces some dead tissue, kills some of the little bits of tissue in the leaf, and as they expand, that kind of rips out. And so you end up with these leaves that look very, very lacy. And it can be where you just have the veins left. It's a very common phenomenon on oak trees. So if it's occurring very early in the season, I'd say it's more likely probably tatters than gypsy moth. But it could be gypsy moth as well, or both.
Are your leaves that are older, the ones that are, you know, produced, actually they're younger, they were produced after the new flush, do they look okay?
They still are a bit yellow.
Okay, but they're not.
But they're intact.
Not attacked, and they. I never really see a lacy because I've got hordes of Japanese beetles, so I.
Yeah.
I do know what the lacy looks like, and it looks like they're eaten, but I can't. You know, they're high in the tree, and so
yeah.
I can't really get the.
Yeah. Well, also look for gypsy moth, but early in spring, that's not gypsy moth season.
Yeah, I think I'm more inclined to think it is this tatters.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you won't see anything because there's no insect that's causing the problem. And it will look as though there have been insects in there feeding on the leaves.
Is this tree next to the drain field, I take it, is not very helpful to it?
No. If it's subject to flooding, no. Mm-hmm. Not a true white oak. If it was a swamp white oak, then it would be happy as a clam.
Yeah, this has maybe 3 or 4 feet of really dark, heavy soil. Mm-hmm. So
yeah.
I assume that may be. Is there any remedy for me other than maybe to try to acidify the soil?
Well, acidifying the soil will help, but is there periods of time where that white oak tree is underwater, the roots?
Never, never.
Never. Oh, okay. So is it just moist but well-drained soil?
It's moist, but heavy, dark black clay soil, and not a very particularly good drainage soil.
Yeah. I'm more inclined to think at this point it's a pH issue, and you would need to put down some elemental sulfur, which does take a while for it to work. There are other products that a professional certified arborist could apply. It's actually micro injections into the root flare around the base of the tree, and that will green it up quite nicely. And it may have to be done every 2 years.
It's a short-term fix.
It's a short-term fix, but it will turn your tree green.
Mm-hmm.
But a combination of both of those would be needed.
And I would suggest if you're going to be applying sulfur to the soil that you get a soil nutrient test and pH test done before you go do that, because you need to know how much of the material to apply to get the pH down to the appropriate level. And the only way you're going to be able to find that out is to have it tested.
Soil test. Yeah.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. An email from Mary Ann. For the first time ever, our snow on the mountain is very rusty. What should we do about that?
Is that the goutweed?
Yep.
Is that what we're talking about? Because I know another plant by snow on the mountain. So
yeah, I do too.
That, in my opinion, is biological control of that particular plant.
It's very aggressive.
It's a very aggressive and very weedy. It's most likely a disease called Septoria leaf spot. That's what I typically see on that particular plant, causing a lot of browning of the leaves. Well, again, it's such an aggressive plant that I really don't want to make a fungicide recommendation, but if you wanted to get something like copper or a product containing chlorothalonil, as long as it's labeled for use on ornamentals, you could potentially apply that. These diseases aren't going to kill off that plant. It's very, very hardy, and will come back with a vengeance next year. But if you are concerned about it and you've got it in a critical area where it looks really bad, then you could make fungicide treatments, but you need to apply them before you start to see any symptoms. So if you have an idea this year of when the disease started, you want to go out about 2 weeks before that next year and begin applications. And you may have to make routine applications about every 7 to 14 days if we have relatively wet weather, because it's a very common disease. It's related to the disease that causes the defoliation on tomatoes. Slightly different organism, but closely related.
There you go. And we have a caller, Sarah, wondering when to prune her, is it Weigela?
Weigelia.
Weigelia?
Yeah.
Okay.
With Weigelias, I often prune them in the dormant season. They do flower in June. Another time is you can prune them right after they're done flowering. It's kind of late in the season right now to do heavy pruning on them.
Yeah, and I would go for the dormant season pruning, because from a plant pathologist standpoint, I worry about opening up wounds in plants during the summer when it's a little wetter and it's hotter, because that provides an entry point for certain types of disease organisms.
Yeah, though Weigelias are pretty tough.
Yeah.
They really don't
get... in a general sense, I prefer dormant pruning.
On a side note, Japanese beetle tend to leave it alone. I have several cultivars in my yard, and they're not eating it. Amazing.
All right, there you go. Brian Huddleston and Laura Jowell, specialists from the UW Extension and the UW Madison, our guests here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at plant disease issues in the garden and lawn with our two guests today, Brian Huddleston, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic, Laura Jowell, professor and extension specialist of woody ornamentals at UW Madison. We have an email from Mary who says a clematis, which has been healthy for 3 or 4 years, blooming in July, reached the blooming stage this summer, then in just a few days suddenly turned brown and died. I cut it back to the ground, haven't seen any sign of regrowth, wondering if planting another in the same area next spring would be a bad idea due to something remaining in the soil.
I'd be a little bit hesitant to replant a clematis in that area. There are several diseases that might cause a problem. It could be a root rot. There's a clematis wilt. My understanding, though, that's really technically a canker disease. It's a foma, I think, that technically causes that, and it'll girdle the vines and cause them to die back. There's other diseases like verticillium wilt that might be a problem, and those could all hang around for a little while in the soil, so I would put something else in that area. In general, if you've got plants that are dying from a known disease, it's best not to plant the same plant back in that area.
A Facebook question from Elizabeth. I just discovered my beloved cucumbers became a victim to bacterial wilt from cucumber beetles. I'm an organic, rather newbie gardener. I've cut off all of the wilted vines, which are most of my plants. Now I'm unsure what to do. Can I eat the cucumbers that have grown already?
Yes, that shouldn't be a problem to eat the cucumbers. This is a disease. It's a bacterial disease, but the bacterium is brought into the plants by cucumber beetles. The beetles mm-hmm. feed and drop off the bacterium. It gets into the water conducting tissue and blocks it off and causes wilting. The other thing I would definitely watch for, though, I would cut some of those wilted vines down the length and check for larvae because there is a vine borer that can cause some dieback as well. But the fruits that were on the plants, if they're still looking good, they should be perfectly edible.
Can she start over for a fall crop?
Yes, again, because the bacterium is brought in by cucumber beetles, as long as you try to keep the cucumber beetles under control, if you would still have some around, that should work.
Mary and Brown Deer, we're on to you now. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I have two questions, and thank you for the garden show. I listen every week. We've had evergreen bittersweet that grew up a wall, and we've had it a long time, but gradually over the years it was overwhelmed with the scale, and I wondered, is that particularly susceptible to that, or were we just unlucky?
Are you sure it's bittersweet? Because I do not know of evergreen bittersweet.
Well, that was the cultivar, what it was called. I bought it at a fairly nice nursery at the time. It's a shiny green leaf that does manage to hang on all winter.
Okay, it could be, and it's related to it. There is a euonymus, big leaf winter creeper, and it has fruit just like a bittersweet. It's in the same family.
Mm-hmm.
And that is evergreen, and that one is extremely susceptible
euonymus
to
scale.
Euonymus scale. It's a white scale, gets all over the branches.
Yes.
It's something when I did landscape maintenance, we used to spray dormant oil on, seemed like every year, because it is just so susceptible to it.
And we do have a fact sheet on that, I believe. Are you hooked up to the internet?
Yes.
Yeah, if you go to the horticulture website, hort.uwex.edu, there is a fact sheet, I believe, on that particular problem.
That's interesting. Can I ask just one more?
Sure.
Curiosity question. I've noticed the last year that some of the plantings of small trees in the median strips, so these are, you know,
city trees,
arborists doing this, that they have a small kind of triangular-shaped plastic bag around the bottom.
Yep, it's a gator bag. And gator bags, you fill up with water, and at the bottom where it touches the soil around the root system of the tree, it very slowly percolates water into the root system. So it's a nice, slow, steady flow of water, and it's a wonderful way for municipalities to water trees. Because if you don't water them after you plant them, they'll die.
Yep.
Don't they have to replenish that occasionally?
Yeah, they'll have to refill the bags.
Okay.
Oh. Yeah, so they'll come by with a tanker truck and fill them up.
Wonderful. I've looked at that and worried about it being against the bark. And
No.
Well,
they take
them
off in the winter. Yeah. At least they should.
Yeah, and that is that's a really great concern. I mean, that's a very, very astute observation, because you can trap moisture underneath those potentially, and you know it could be a possible place where disease-causing organisms could get in. But if they're used properly, that shouldn't be an issue.
Yeah, they need water. This year it's been exceptionally dry this part of the state.
Yep.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mary, for calling. Joyce and Eau Claire, on to you now. Hi, Joyce.
Hi. I'm a first-time caller and a long-time listener.
Well, thanks for calling.
I have three questions. Number one, I have a red maple. I went out and measured. It's 3 feet in diameter at a 5-foot height.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a really healthy tree. It's one of the first ones in the area to have lots of flowers in the spring. We bought this property from people who are now deceased, but we're thinking it's 30 to 35 years that this tree has been growing. And last year I noticed there was a big branch at the top that was completely dead.
Mm-hmm.
This year I just got back from vacation 2 weeks in Colorado, and what I noticed is that whole area, that branch and possibly more, it seems to be filtering down, has all dead leaves.
Well, let's address that first.
Yeah, the fact that you're talking about branched, so it was an individual branch first, and now you've got a kind of a cluster of branches that's dying, is that correct?
Correct.
Yeah, that makes me wonder about verticillium wilt. This is a fungal disease. Maples are commonly affected by this particular disease. The fungus is in the soil. It infects through the roots, and it blocks off the water-conducting tissue, and you get this kind of sectional dieback in the tree. If it were a more general kind of dieback across the upper canopy, across the entire upper canopy, then I'd worry more about maybe girdling roots or something of that sort. But this sectional dieback is more typical of vert.
Yeah.
Girdling... I don't notice any chewing at the bottom, no mm-hmm. rabbit.
Yeah.
No. Now, girdling roots, what girdling roots is where the actual roots of the tree start, instead of growing out away from the trunk, they start to grow around the trunk, and they act like a noose, and they cut off the water conducting tissue on that side of the tree. Sometimes it's a foot below ground, you don't even see it, and that was a result of the tree being planted too deep. So there's two things that could be going on here.
If you're interested in trying to figure out if it is verticillium wilt, if you can get me some of those branches into my clinic, we can actually test for that particular disease, but we need some of the branches that have recently died back.
That means I have to go up like.
If you're way up in the tree, this would be a situation where you would call a certified arborist to come and climb the tree for you and collect a sample for you. Now, you're talking about some expense to do this if you really want to test. But
Would hate to lose this tree because.
The thing of it is, if it is verticillium, there's not really much that I can tell you to treat this particular tree. What it becomes is an issue.
Anyway.
It becomes an issue of what you can replant in that area once the tree has died. Because there are a lot of different types of trees that are very susceptible to this particular fungus, so you've got to be very careful about replacement.
And you want to make sure.
If I would replace it, I would like a fast grower because we need the shade. I've always loved silver maples, but they're short-lived.
Yeah, and they have a lot of problems structurally.
Oh, do they?
Yeah. A lot of problems structurally. It's one of the worst trees to be anywhere within 100 feet of it during a storm. Mm-hmm. They're very susceptible to storm damage. And because if it is indeed verticillium wilt, you don't want to replant another maple.
Yeah, silver maple isn't a bad choice, quite frankly, because they're not as susceptible, quite frankly, as other maples.
Yeah, but
no for other reasons.
Many reasons,
Mm-hmm. Okay.
All right.
I'm trying to think of other trees that are fast
growing. Oh, other fast growing in that particular area, and Brian, you'll have to help me here. Mm-hmm. Is hackberry susceptible to verticillium?
Not that I'm aware of.
Yeah, hackberry would be one.
But then you got to live with nipple gall.
Well, that doesn't bother me.
That doesn't bother me, but it bothers some people. There's always something. Yeah. That's a occupational hazard on my part. I can think of something that'll go wrong with any plant.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think of ones that aren't susceptible. So many of them are.
Well, I know honey locust is, but it's got a lot of other problems, too.
Yeah, it does.
Kentucky coffee tree, which is your favorite, is another one.
It's one of my favorites. It's not real fast growing. I mean, it's it tends to look like the Charlie Brown Christmas tree in the wintertime with very little branching. But when it gets bigger, it's a beautiful tree. Really nice tree. No serious pest problems. That's Kentucky coffee tree.
Yeah, we have some on campus. They're quite nice.
Okay.
All right.
That takes care of that issue. Number two.
Okay.
I have several rhododendrons. All of them are doing wonderfully except for one, which probably gets a little more sun than the rest.
Okay. Do you know what type of rhododendron it is?
No.
Okay. Is it a big leaf or a little leaf?
They all look the same to me. I mean, they're all, I would say, big leaf.
Okay. Well, with rhododendrons, and Brian's kind of smiling here because this is often a sample he gets, they're very, very susceptible to root rot. And, in fact, that's probably, it could be have some root rot issues. Another thing is, if it is in too much sun, it can scorch. They have a very small root system. They need good moisture all the time and excellent soil that is well drained.
The other thing is, do you happen to have a walnut near that particular shrub?
There are walnuts in the land.
Because I had an azalea / rhododendron in my yard, and a squirrel planted a walnut nut at the about 3 feet from that particular shrub, and I made the mistake of not taking care of it. And several years later, my shrub totally collapsed very rapidly. And when I dug it up, I had a walnut root through the root mass of the azalea, and that had taken out that particular shrub. Walnuts produce toxins, and azaleas and rhododendrons tend to be very sensitive. So that could be part of what you're dealing with as well.
So that's there's always something, isn't there?
Mm-hmm.
Always something. And I wanted to mention that we have a link on our Facebook page. If you want to go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, there's a link to the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic. So you can just click on it and it'll take you right to the clinic and you can get the instructions and all the
submitting samples. And also the fact sheets that we've been talking about are not only available at our horticulture website, but I have them all on my website as well.
So that's, again, go to the Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, and you'll find that.
And there's contact information for me as well if folks have questions after I'm off the air.
Brian Huddleston, Director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at the UW-Madison Department of Plant Pathology, and Laura Gell, Professor and Extension Specialist for Woody Ornamentals in the Department of Horticulture at UW-Madison. Our guests here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at issues around the garden on this edition of Garden Talk, Larry Mueller here with my guest Brian Huddleston, Director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at UW-Madison in the Department of Plant Pathology, and Laura Gell, who's in the Department of Horticulture, where she is a professor and extension specialist in woody ornamentals in particular. Although she knows a lot about things too, so we try to stick to those areas though when we have them on. And you can join in if you have a question or comment. The number to call 1-800-642-1234. Email talk@wpr.org or go to our Facebook page and post a question or even a photo at the Larry Mueller Show. Debbie in Loganville's been waiting a long time, so let's go there. Hi, Debbie. Thank you for waiting.
Hi. I have two questions related to late blight in tomatoes.
Okay.
My tomatoes have been suffering from it for the last month or so, limping along. I've been spraying with copper product and also bee subtilis, but evidently not spraying enough. What I'm wondering about is how come, I had it for the first time last year, and last year it affected the leaves, but not the fruit. This year it seems to be affecting mostly the fruit, and I'm wondering what's
the fruit look like?
It looks, one might think that if you didn't know blossom end rot real well, one might think that that's what it was initially, but it's not. It starts out affecting the blossom end and gets bigger and bigger in sort of concentric style, and pretty soon rot takes over and the fruit is gone.
Yeah, your plants are still alive?
Yes, I've been, like I said, I've been using the sprays, and also I've been pulling off the sick parts.
And it started kind of at the bottom of the plants?
I can't really remember.
Okay, because my expectation would be if you were actually dealing with late blight, those plants would be dead already. They would have died very, very rapidly. Usually we don't find spraying after you start to see symptoms as being an effective control, and the pathogen is quite aggressive and will kill them.
I've started spraying this even before I transplanted.
Okay. I suggest what you do is, if this really is late blight, and I'm not sure that it is, but I suggest getting a sample into my clinic for testing. We do that actually for free if you think you have a late blight problem, because we're trying to track that particular disease in the state. But if you're seeing the rot on the bottom surface of the fruits and you're seeing plants that are still staying alive even though they have the disease, I'm a little doubtful that it really is late blight, because that pathogen, that disease, typically kills the plants quite rapidly.
Last year, what happened was my Cherokee purples turned out to be very susceptible.
Okay.
And it killed those just
outright.
Okay.
The others were not as susceptible, but mm-hmm. they got it depending on how close they were to the Cherokee purples. And they, after I trimmed off the diseased parts,
mm-hmm.
They seemed to make a little bit of a comeback towards the end of the season.
Okay. I really suggest that you get a sample in for us to verify, because I'd like to know for certain whether or not you are dealing with a late blight problem. And you can submit that sample through your county extension office. And like I said, it is a free diagnosis. Okay. And that's available to basically anyone in the state if they think they have late blight. We will do that diagnosis for free. And that way we can figure out whether it is late blight. And if it is, I can provide recommendations. But I'm concerned that it may be a combination of blossom end rot and one of the other leaf blights on tomatoes. So yeah. We really need to figure that out before we can really make recommendations for you.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Josh in Madison, we're on to you now. Hi, Josh.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks for calling.
My pleasure, thank you. Basically, last year I planted a fairly large prairie fire crabapple, and I actually got that recommendation from UW Extension's materials. It was looking kind of shaggy at first, and I thought, well, it's just being transplanted. This year, spring started out really great, and it's actually grown quite a bit, but then it started to get defoliated and the leaves got black spots on it. I had an arborist come out and they diagnosed it as apple scab.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that prairie fire was resistant mm-hmm. to apple scab. So a couple of things. The arborist recommended that, he said, well, if you don't have a emotional attachment to the tree, he'd recommend replacing it.
Yeah.
That seemed kind of drastic, so I wanted to check on that.
Mm-hmm.
But my other thought was, all right, if I replace it with another crab apple, isn't that just going to get infected as well? Because I went with one I thought was resistant.
Right.
I guess those are the two things.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Prairie fire was resistant for a long time, and only within the last couple years have we started to see some apple scab, not heavy, but some. Brian, correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah.
Prairie fire is a beautiful crab apple with that really nice, deep maroon flower and dark burgundy fruit. If it is indeed apple scab, I'm sorry that you unfortunately have that in the apple scab in your yard. If you do plant with another crab, you know, it may be resistant, but it's not immune. And a lot of these trees may develop susceptibility later on, or as Brian said, the pathogen.
The pathogen you can select for. Whenever you're putting these resistant varieties out in the environment, what you're doing is basically providing a growth platform for the pathogen, and you select for variants of the pathogen that can overcome the resistance. So we do sometimes see what we call failure in resistance. So you basically have a variety that has some resistance, but you select for a subpopulation of the pathogen that eventually becomes the predominant
yeah.
pathogen in the environment that can overcome that resistance. And that does happen on occasion.
Yeah, I've not seen really bad defoliation on prairie fire. It's interesting that you are.
Mm-hmm. It is a recent transplant,
yeah.
too, so there may be some
transplant shock
issues.
Well.
You may want to get a sample, again, into my clinic just for verification that it is apple scab, and we can kind of give an assessment of whether or not we think that's a real serious problem on the tree.
Mm-hmm.
Your options are, and it's funny that your arborist asked that question about emotional attachment, because that was exactly the question I was going to ask. Because oftentimes, if it's one of the older varieties, which are very susceptible, that's what I recommend is removal and replacement with a newer variety that has some resistance. But any resistant plant that you plant, over time, that resistance may not hold up. Just mm-hmm. as a general rule of thumb, resistance isn't forever necessarily.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. And Gene in Grand Chute, we're on to you now. Hi, Gene. Gene, are you there? Well, I guess we lost Jean. Mary in Brookfield, let's go there. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Thank you. I have a 35-year-old blue spruce that has lost all its needles except the new growth. Mm-hmm. Everything behind new growth is gone. And I'd kind of like to know if it's a goner, and if it is, then I'll have a second question.
Yeah, it's not a lethal disease. We see this commonly on spruces, particularly blue spruce or Colorado blue spruce. It's a fungal disease called Rhizosphera needle cast. And again, we do have a fact sheet on this particular disease, but it's a fungus that infects the needles. And when the needles are back in the canopy where it's a little bit moister, it tends to get very severe and you lose a lot of the leaves and you see exactly what you've described, which are kind of nude branches out to the tips where the tips look nice and healthy. It is not a fatal disease, but it will sometimes make the trees look so ugly that you wish they were dead.
Yeah.
That's the problem. And it really comes down to an aesthetic question. Is that tree doing aesthetically in your landscape what you want it to do?
Yeah. Okay, and then if I should decide to take it down and this fungus is around and I'm sure it's there, would a bald cypress, could that go nearby? It wouldn't be in the exact location, but it would be nearby within about 10 feet.
Okay, where you're in Brookfield?
Yes.
Yeah. Bald cypress is one of my very favorite trees. I have one in my yard. I would get the cultivar Shawnee Brave. And Shawnee Brave is a little bit more upright growing, but it's I think it's a little bit hardier than just the species, because I've seen some, the species is seed propagated and you're not sure where it's coming from, where Shawnee Brave is a known cultivar and has to be propagated vegetatively. So you are getting that correct plant. It's a wonderful, very tough tree, likes wet soils, but it can tolerate some drier soils, just not extremely high pH. And no, it won't, as far as I know, does not get the Rhizosphera.
No.
It's a great tree.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. And Dean in Campbellsport, on to you. Hi, Dean.
Good afternoon. I have I had two autumn blaze maples, identical trees that were 11 years old. Last fall, one of them, the leaves started turning brown rather than changing color about the time the leaves normally would change color. This spring, that tree was completely dead. It never even leafed out. The one next to it showed signs, showing signs, I believe, also of verticillium. I'm sure that's what killed the first one. There were two trees about 6 years ago across the street from this property that lost two maples to verticillium. The tree next to it this spring, about the south third of the tree leafed out normally. The rest of it, the leaves looked a lot sparser than normal. They were smaller and not as lush. I'm fairly certain that's got verticillium. My question is, does it make sense to take the tree down preemptively or to wait to see how the tree progresses? Is it causing a risk to other trees in the area? I don't think there's another. I have four or five other maple trees maybe within several hundred feet, but nothing closer than at least 50 feet, I would say.
Yeah,
nothing that the roots touch.
I wouldn't worry that much about removing those trees right now, because most typically the infections of a tree are going to come in through the root system, and it's really a function of the roots of the tree growing through an area in the soil where the verticillium fungus is present. So you can get movement of the fungus in the leaves. That's been documented, but I wouldn't expect that to be a primary source of infecting a large established tree. So I would be careful to carefully collect up the leaves. I would not use them as a mulch in your yard, and I don't necessarily think I would even compost those. If you suspect that the tree has verticillium wilt, you could take it to somebody who composts things commercially where they can get very high temperature and get good decay of the material, and I think that's a better option for getting rid of that particular type of material that you think might be contaminated with verticillium.
You don't think there's anything to be gained by taking this tree down until I see for sure if it's going to die off, how quickly it's going to die off?
Yeah, it's again, it's mainly an aesthetic question again. It's
right.
Does the tree do for you in the landscape what you want aesthetically? And if it looks reasonable at this point, I wouldn't remove it. If it starts to get to the point where you just don't like looking at it, then that would be a situation where you could consider replacing the tree with something else. And in fact, you might want to consider going ahead and planting something if it looks like it's declining relatively rapidly, so you can get at least some new growth on a tree before that original tree goes down.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. I have an email from Susan in Menominee Falls. I have a courtyard that's enclosed by an alpine currant hedge. I've noticed that there are areas, whole branches really, that are scaly looking and dying out. I've pruned some out, but wondering if this is going to kill the hedge or whether there's something I should do to stop this from occurring or keep it from spreading. It's appearing on different plants in the hedge. There are 20 plants.
It could be one of the canker diseases. Canker diseases are oftentimes fungal, and the fungus is a localized infection. The fungus infects the branch and then girdles it, and that'll cause dieback. Sometimes those can get into crowns and kill off an entire shrub. Oftentimes you can manage them through pruning, and that will do a couple things. One, it removes the fungus so that if it's producing spores, you don't get reinfection. It also opens up the canopy of the shrub so it dries a little bit more rapidly, and that'll help prevent infections as well. I am working actually on an alpine currant right now that has very similar sounding symptoms to what you're describing. And we don't know exactly what might be causing the problem at this point, but I suspect it's one of these fungal pathogens.
Aren't they susceptible to anthracnose?
There is an anthracnose disease on alpine currants. I would expect that more in the leaves. I'm thinking maybe something like Phomopsis, which is a fungus that will girdle branches, cause a branch dieback.
We have an email from Jan in Hayward, and she says, this is the first time I've ever had a problem growing zucchini. The leaves are huge, get blossoms, and small zooks start to grow, but then they rot from the blossom end when they get a few inches long. Sounds like blossom end rot, but my tomatoes and peppers planted right next to them are doing fine, show no signs. I see no signs of bugs. What do you think?
I think blossom end rot, that would be my vote. We do see that on cucurbits, so that includes squashes and pumpkins and cucumbers and those related plants. So that may be a situation, again, when she plants next year, add a little extra calcium to the soil, and she may want to do that around her tomatoes and peppers as well, just to preventatively keep the problem from being an issue next year.
And Cindy wonders, what should she use for leaf spot on red raspberry plants, and when should it be applied? Also, what should I use to fertilize red raspberries? I don't know how you can incorporate the fertilizer when there are so many roots.
I can't really comment on the fertilization issue and the leaf spot issue. That would be a situation where I would really recommend getting a sample in for a diagnosis, because people describe leaf spots very differently, and it may be a true leaf spot where there's a fungus infecting the leaf tissue causing a spot. It may be something else that's leading to spotting or dead areas on the leaves, and we really need to tease that apart. I hate to make a fungicide recommendation without knowing exactly what might be causing the problem.
Bob and Eau Claire wonders what Imprelis was being used for initially. What was its purpose?
It's a herbicide. It was applied to turf grass to take care of the weeds.
And an email from Bonnie in Bear Valley. A friend visited from Illinois and gave me 3 potted wisteria cuttings. Do these plants like sun or shade? Any growing tips?
Wisteria likes full sun. It's a very heavy vine. It needs extremely strong support to climb on, meaning a trellis, it could snap in half. You need something like a 4x6 pole or a pergola for it to grow on. And they're pretty easy. The most important thing is don't over-fertilize them with nitrogen, because if you put too much nitrogen down, they will not flower. I also prune mine back pretty hard every year, and that helps initiate floral production. If you have a wisteria that hasn't flowered in years, try pruning it back to within on the side branches coming off the main branches. Bring those side branches back to within about 2 buds from the main branch on the side branches. It's hard to describe. Mm-hmm. But that will has often helped initiate floral production instead of leaf production.
How hardy are those around here?
The Kentucky wisteria is perfectly hardy for us. I would avoid the Chinese or Japanese wisteria. They're invasive and not reliably hardy in many parts of the state.
Here's Ann from Madison with a question for you. Hi, Ann.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. We have a birch tree that is, I guess I refigured, it's 36 years old. And last summer, we had I don't know what it was. It was a oozing, rust-colored stuff coming down the...
We already know what you're talking about.
I'm just laughing here because I get this question every once. It was early in the spring, I take it, or fairly early in the spring?
It was actually in summer. It was last year, and I can't remember just exactly when it was.
Yeah, we oftentimes see this on birches relatively early in the spring as they come out of dormancy, and a lot of the sap is flowing. If there are wounds in the side of the tree, some of the sap will come out onto the bark. And you can get these very rusty colored discolorations. And
looks like it's bleeding.
Yeah, and it can be anywhere from kind of an orange color all the way to kind of Barbie pink. And it's just microorganisms growing in that sap that's coming out of the tree. It's usually yeasts, which oftentimes are very highly colored, and they tend to disappear. After a while, the wounds will close over and the sap will stop flowing, and then this growth will kind of dry up. So it's not anything to worry about. It is very, very distinctive when you see it, and kind of scary.
Yeah, it was awful. Now, this year, of course, the Japanese beetle loves the tree, and we have, you know, just bushels of leaves coming down all late. Is there? I know there's nothing I can do with them, and I can't pick them up off because it's a tall tree. I was on a ladder trying to do that the other day. But is there anything I can do to help the tree as far as should I be watering it now?
Absolutely water your tree. With Japanese beetle, there is systemics that you can apply at the base of the tree, systemic insecticides that will be taken up by the tree roots and help reduce Japanese beetle feeding. However, it's too late now, obviously.
Yeah, we do have a fact sheet on Japanese beetle, again, at our website, our Hort website, and it does talk about these sorts of systemic treatments, so you may want to check that out. Because you have to get the timing appropriate as
very
well.
Very appropriate.
Yeah.
Marie, thank you very much, Ann, for calling. Marie in Tomahawk, it's your turn. Hi, Marie.
Hi. I have it's called a Dapple Dawn Lilac. And you're familiar with that?
Yep. Yeah, it's a cultivar of common lilac.
Laura's writing a book on lilacs, so she better know about that.
Well, anyway, I think it has like powdery mildew.
Yep.
It's just, so that's a common problem.
Oh, yeah.
Definitely. And don't worry about it. You have much more important things to worry about in your life. It's a pretty cosmetic disease on lilac. So it's not something I would get terribly concerned about. Lilacs seem to be very well adapted and very tolerant of powdery mildew.
Yeah.
So
make sure your plant's in full sun, and you might want to do some selective pruning to increase air circulation in the plant.
There you go. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. And Richard in Washington Island, you have a quick question.
Yeah, I sure do. About 4 years ago, my wife and I bought a fairly large parcel in Washington Island with the mature beech trees, and they're gorgeous. They're all dying off.
Yeah. When I saw that and I saw where you're from, the first thing that popped in my head was beech bark disease. It has been found up there in Door County and Washington Island area.
Yeah, it's a combination of an insect problem, and that brings in a fungus, a Nectria species,
canker,
and that
yeah.
will cause a localized infection and, again, cause death of trunks and branches. And oftentimes you get this kind of roughened sort of area on the bark, which is a typical symptom of the disease.
Anything to do for it?
Unfortunately, no, not that I'm aware
no,
of.
No,
I'm not an expert on that disease, but I'm
not
aware
either,
of anything.
But it's been prevalent in the eastern U.S. and in Michigan, and unfortunately we're starting to get it in Wisconsin. And there's been quite a bit of updates, and I'm sure if you do you have access to a computer?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, if you Google beech bark disease, it's called beech bark disease, and you'll get a plethora of information that's been put out by the U.S. Forest Service on this very destructive. There is some natural selection. They have seen some beech trees that were growing right next to ones that were dead from beech bark disease that didn't have any. So
yeah. So there you go. Sorry for that bad news, not the best way to end, but we're out of time. Thank you guys so much for being with us. You'll come back, I assume, and be with
Certainly.
Us again.
Absolutely. It's fun.
Brian Adelson, Director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at the UW-Madison Department of Plant Pathology, and Laura Jell, Professor and Extension Specialist of Woody Ornamentals in the Department of Horticulture at the UW-Madison. Great to have them along, and they'll be back. We'll do this again. Monday, we'll take a look at your physical therapy issues with Bill Boys and Alton, Lori Tyne Brody. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network.